The time has come.
I like that.
The time is now. For Victoria Stilwell's Positively Podcast. She's a world-renowned dog trainer.
Seen enough dogs today, have you?
She's the host of It's Me or the Dog.
I'm coming to train you.
Along with co-host Holly Ferver.
You don't play around with that name, do you?
I am a fan of Shwethi Balls.
She's Victoria Stilwell, and she's ready to go.
This is a lovely way to start the day.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers.
I see some poo here.
I feel a little bit better now because I'm the only one who usually feels stupid during the podcast.
Now, let's head to the studio and get this Positively Podcast started.
Welcome to my podcast, everybody. I hope you're well, and I hope that you have been enjoying your time with your dogs. This podcast has evolved. It's evolved over the years that it's been on air, and now we have more guests, and I love the fact that we have more guests because, yes, we do talk a lot about dogs. Yes, I will answer your questions, but this gives me an opportunity to interview some pretty incredible people. And today I'm really excited because, and I know I say that every week, but because there's so many incredible people to interview, but I'm telling you today, this is different. When I was a very awkward teenager, I would watch a certain show called Top of the Pops. And I would watch this guy presenting it, and he was so cool. And he wore the most coolest jackets with, like, he would roll up his sleeves and very 80s. And I was like, gosh, he's so cool. And I was so awkward. And then I heard him on Capital Radio, and I heard him on the BBC radio, and Nicky Campbell was everywhere. And so for a teenager, you know, you have these people that you go, oh, you look at and you go, oh, God, I wish I was as cool as them. Fast forward to about, was it 4 years ago? That I met Nicky Campbell at an RSPCA Hero Awards for Animal Hero Awards. And now, weirdly, I'm interviewing him because he's my guest on the podcast. Welcome, Nicky Campbell. I cannot believe that, A, I can see you, and B, I'm interviewing you.
Wow, unbelievable. That's quite a lovely intro. Goodness. Well, do you know that Top of the Pops? When did I do it? Years and years ago. I was in the music radio, and now I do talk radio and talk TV, and I do the British version of Long Lost Family, which I know is on in the States as well. But yeah. When did I do that? I did Top of the Pops, which is all the 88 to 94, yes. I think, something like that. Yeah. Something like that. And the thing is, they run it on one of the TV channels here, like BBC Four. So you've got BBC One and BBC Two are the main channels. Then you've got BBC Three and BBC Four, which are great. They do great stuff on them. And they run it on Top of the Pops on BBC Four on a Friday night very often. So they play these old 89, 90, you know, 91, all those versions where I'm wearing the aforementioned terrible clothes. You look at them now and you think, how could we wear that stuff? How did we look? We look like clowns.
But then we thought we looked amazing. And we did, because I mean, I had the poofy hair, I had everything. I mean, I was so unbelievably awkward. Nicky, you wouldn't have looked at me twice, but I always wanted to be. No, you wouldn't. I always wanted to be in the audience of Top of the Pops, but I never quite got there. And but it for kids like me, it was an introduction into music. And not only, I mean, we had radio, we didn't have social media then, we didn't have cell phones, that our lives centered around the radio. I would get up in the morning and listen to Capital Radio before I went to school. I mean, our lives were radio and Top of the Pops.
Me too. I've been obsessed and totally in love with radio all my life. The other show that I used to do, which people in the States will know, is Wheel of Fortune as well. I did that for about 6 years, which is a strange thing to do. But you know, when I was wonderful, great fun. But when I know when Top of the Pops is on, right, when they're rerunning it, because I'll be sitting there having a beer on the sofa in the evening with my lovely dogs and Maxwell by my feet, because I'm a total, not just a dog lover, I'm a dog adorer. I could not live life without dogs. And I'll start getting these texts saying, you know, pictures of me with this strange hair and so forth, and people sending me screen grabs. And then I've got daughters, they're aged 17 and 20 and 21 and 22. And if a couple of them are around, I say, have a look at this. And then it's like, oh my God. And then it's cringe. So it's really weird for them to see that. And I look at it and I think, my God, it's like another person. Sometimes I'm a little bit manic on it. But what a gig it was, because I met all sorts of people and also Radio One, you know.
How did you get that gig? How did you get it?
Because, well, I was on Capital.
The gig,
yeah.
To get.
Well, I was on Capital Radio. I came down from local radio in Scotland. I sent them a tape. They got me down to Capital Radio, which is a big London station. And I was on Capital Radio. Then the national station signed me up. And I've always liked not just playing the records. I love the music. I love that. And the communicating through music, like having the world's greatest record player. You get something. It's like getting someone in your bedroom and say, listen to this, except you're doing it for millions. I just love that. You know, introducing people to music. It's the best thing. If you love a song, introduce them to it as well. So I loved doing that. I also loved speaking and communicating and interviewing. So the two things coalesced in many ways. And then I went to Radio One, and Radio One was, I was there for 10 years, which was the national rock and pop station. I did a late night radio. Oh, I love late night radio. Just, we used to smoke in those days. And I'd be like in the studio with the smoke swirling around the studio, playing this amazing music and really, you know, really connecting with people. They flew me first class to Long Island to interview the Rolling Stones when I was what, 28?
Come on. I mean, I don't think you can get a better gig than that.
Ridiculous. They flew me to Miami Beach to interview Barry Gibb and Robin and Morris. And I went to Barry's house. I remember I loved them. They showed me the piano where they wrote "How Deep Is Your Love," and they showed me the house and showed me all the pictures they had with Michael Jackson and Barbara Streisand and everything. And you've got to kind of keep in check with this stuff. It's like the first time I met Paul McCartney, a Beatle. And the first time I met Paul McCartney, it was like I had to do a little thing with him, a little interview with him at Radio One. And he came in, I went, "Hi, Paul." He went, "Hi, Nicky." I said, "Hi, Paul. It's really nice to meet you. So, and we'll just do the interview, and it'll be about 10 minutes." And I was saying that, but inside I was going, I have to go for it. Inside I was going, "Ah! Ah! It's Paul McCartney." It's okay, Maxwell. Don't worry. Maxwell's got all alarm. I was shaking. "You okay, boy?"
The dog's like, "Oh, what just happened?
What the hell?" So it's about and meeting David Bowie as well. It's about trying to keep control when you're a fan, you know, when you're a fan.
Yeah, I know exactly that, because I had pictures of David Bowie on my wall. So he was my first music crush. And then the Bee Gees, I think it was the album called Tragedy, but it was the first album that I bought. Mm. And I remember I was so proud of it. I got out of the car with my mum and I had the album in my arm. And there were all these boys on their bicycles outside my house. And I thought, well, I'm going to show them what I got. So I sort of walked on my drive and sort of showed them that I had the album, didn't talk to them. And I was so proud of it. And then they made fun of me because I liked the Bee Gees.
Oh,
it was
great.
Crushing.
Yeah, but see, they don't know. I bet now they wouldn't be making fun of you, because they are now acknowledged as, you know, looking back, great songs, fantastically crafted songs, which grabbed the zeitgeist by its balls. I mean, they were incredible songwriters, incredible performers. You hear one of those songs, and it's the potency of music. Music is like a time machine. Mm. It takes you back to that place that you were. I can hear anything from 1976 when I was 15, having a hormonal explosion, and I'm right back. I had one of those 70s stations on the other day, playing all the music from the 70s. I felt strangely wistful and sad and nostalgic. I was just transported. And every single record had a different feel and a different memory, and remembering girlfriends and remembering incidents and remembering being there with my mates. And the Bee Gees, when you hear those records, you're right there. You're right back there at that time.
Quick break here to get a word from this episode's sponsor, the Victoria Stillwell Academy. With everything going on in the world these days, online and distance learning is becoming more and more common. Over the past few years, there's been a steady increase in the number of online courses that are available to help people learn everything from how to play the guitar to how to do high-level coding for websites. Brand name universities have been offering online courses for a few years, and people have gotten more and more used to the concept of learning via their phones or computers. But now the coronavirus situation has supercharged the idea of online learning and telecommuting. With most colleges and universities moving all of their classes online, employers encouraging people to work from home, and even many schools shifting their lessons for children to online platforms. The good news is that educators like the Victoria Stillwell Academy that have been offering online courses for a while have been working hard to develop super engaging and powerful online learning protocols that help learners get the most out of their distance learning. While there are still some schools that simply put their older content online as slides, a PDF, or a repurposed static audio lecture and leave it to their students to try their best, now there are better options. The Victoria Stillwell Academy is a leader, not just in providing the best dog training educational content, but also in the unique and powerful ways that that content is delivered to the learner. Whether you're a dog owner looking for free courses to help build your dog's confidence, a self-described dog geek itching to get the latest information about dog behavior, or someone aspiring to change your career path to work with dogs for a living, the Victoria Stillwell Academy has a powerful suite of learner-centered, performance-based online courses available for you to start today. All Victoria Stillwell Academy courses are designed by Victoria and VSA's team of psychologists, instructional designers, and specialty experts to ensure a truly dynamic, engaging, and effective learning process. No more plodding through tired old text-based lessons or trying to figure out the point of games that don't address the true root cause of dog behavior. And the best news? You can enroll in one of the Victoria Stillwell Academy's free starter courses right now for no charge. Just go to vsdogtrainingacademy.com and click on the Enroll button to get started. If you're ready to take your dog training knowledge to the next level, you can enroll in the fully refundable Fundamentals of Dog Training and Behavior course today and get $100 off by using promo code PODCAST at checkout. Go to vsdogtrainingacademy.com and choose the Fundamentals course from the top menu. And finally, if you're looking for a school that'll give you the skills, knowledge, and confidence you need to become a professional dog trainer, the Academy's Dog Trainer course is the premier option in dog trainer education. You can talk to an enrollment coordinator today or apply for enrollment right away in our online-only course with the option to upgrade to the in-person track when the time is right in the future. Visit vsdogtrainingacademy.com now to enroll in one of the Victoria Stillwell Academy's dynamic online courses and get started learning right away while staying at home and learning at your own pace. Learn online now with the Victoria Stillwell Academy, the future of dog training.
Sound actually is one of those things that evokes emotional memory. So sound is very much connected with your emotional memory, and same happens with dogs. So we know that when we use sound, in when we're training them, when we're teaching them in the form of words and other different kinds of sounds, that does go deep into the emotional memory. So you being introduced to these people, meeting these legends, really, and even back then they were legends. What kind of, like, how do you move on from that? How do you kind of separate the fact that you are a fan to doing your job?
Well, you've got to just you know, there's two of you, isn't there? As I said, there's the one that says, well, we'll sit down and, you know, do it, and that's great. So listen, Mick, tell me about the Stones, or Keith, about, you know, starting, you know, on all that. And there's a bit inside saying, I cannot believe I'm lucky enough to be here, to be doing this. And I think that's very healthy, because I think the moment that you think, I deserve to be doing here, I deserve to be doing this, and you don't have that voice inside appreciating that the dice has rolled for you supremely, I think it's good to have that the double thing going on, you know. And it's good to meet Paul McCartney and go, all right, Paul, I'm looking forward to talking to you, and here's the question, talk about the album, what about this? It's good to have that thing going on inside. Oh my God, if you told me when I was listening to the Beatles when I was 14, kind of when I discovered them, when I found my sister's cassette, and I put the cassette on, I think it was with the Beatles, and I heard, you won't be long. And then I heard, close your eyes and I'll, and I heard all those songs. I just fell in love with him. Then I discovered Sergeant Pepper. If somebody had told me then, you know that thing you're listening to? You know those guys? One day you'll meet two of those guys. You'll be with two of those guys and you'll interview them, Ringo and Paul, and you'll be with Paul. And also I was flying to South Africa to make a film for Long Lost Family. We'd found somebody in South Africa who was being traced. And I think the TV company, normally they'd fly me business, but the TV company had found a deal. So I was like, they put me in first class because sometimes it's weird stuff goes on. You can get it cheaper than business. TV companies are always, you know, looking after the budget. But they because I was going a long way to do a story, they gave me a, you know, let me turn left, as they say, which is great. So I'm in first class and I'm going through the first class security at Heathrow. And there's Paul. And this is like one of the great moments in my life. Right. There's a lot of people there and they're all looking at Paul. OK. And then Paul looks up at me and he goes, hello, Nicholas.
Well, there you go. I mean, come on. We'll end the podcast right here.
I should have said, stop bothering me, Paul.
You should have done. I had that surreal experience because I was a huge Queen fan. I still am. Mm. And because of all of the animal advocacy that I do, I did have a chance to meet Brian Hare. And we were at the Houses of Parliament. Brian May, sorry. Yeah. See, I'm
with
so
the hair. Brian May Hare. With the hair.
Brian Hare is, I've just been talking about him. He is a cognitive scientist, one of the best cognitive scientists in the world. No, Brian May, who does have a lot of hair that's very soft, by the way, because I gave him a big hug. Anyway, I met him at Parliament. We were having a chat about different animal advocacy and different legislation that was being passed. And so we had a really nice chat and I bought him lunch. So we were the couple of other people, and I had a sort of surreal moment of, here I am, I'm buying Brian May lunch, and now I'm talking with him, and it seemed that at that point it didn't matter what he'd done, didn't matter what I'd done, it didn't matter who I was or he was, because animals connected us, and that's how we got connected, Nikki, wasn't it? Because we both attended the RSPCA Awards that recognizes amazing people that have done incredible things for rescue and beyond. And we were both presenting awards at that time. So tell us, how have you made, not a transition, because you still do a lot of work in television and radio, but what is it with animals? Like, why were you there?
Well, it goes way back. I've just written a whole book about this called,
yes, you do. You have it.
One of the family.
There you go.
I'm not here to plug the book, but I just had it there because I've written this book, Why a Dog Called Maxwell Changed My Life. I talk about my breakdown in it, and I also talk about my lifelong love of animals. And you mentioned Brian May there, Paul McCartney likewise, guys, people who love animals. I'm quite a bigot, really. I am quite a bigot in one way. If people say to me, I don't really like animals or I don't like dogs, I'm immediately suspicious of them, because I think dogs, they are the treasure of life. And if you don't like, I can, you know, when I was coming back in a boat, we'd been I've got a little boat, like one of these ribs thing, a sort of motorboat in the Highlands, and when we were coming back on it after an amazing day on a Highland beach in the West Highlands of Scotland, a remote and beautiful, a giant pod of dolphins came about, and they're all playing by us and jumping and showing off. When I see an elephant, I'd say, when I look at an elephant and a baby elephant, a mother, and I see something more beautiful than any work of art in any art gallery anywhere in the world. And you can pay £20 million for a Van Gogh or a Van Gogh. Well, you can go hang, as far as I'm concerned, because seeing a family of elephants at sunset at a watering hole is unutterably, sublimely beautiful. And I do not understand why everybody doesn't think that. I don't get it.
I don't either. And I think, you know, I've had, obviously, like you, we've sort of been blessed with these lives that where we have been paid to go and experience some incredible things. And three years ago, I came up with the idea for a television show called Dogs with Extraordinary Jobs, which took me around the world filming dogs doing amazing things. And one of the things I'll remember is that we have a dog that detects whale scat in the ocean. And we were up in the San Juan Islands, which is the Pacific Northwest on the western side of the United States near Seattle. And we were filming there with the orca whales.
Oh.
And you're sitting on the boat going, I'm actually getting paid to do this.
Mm.
There is nothing so beautiful. I totally get what you mean. They are a work of art. We need to celebrate them and protect them, which is why I can't understand why people are, well, people hunt them, why people are cruel to them. On the dog side, I am a huge advocate for humane training of dogs. I don't understand why people put shock collars on dogs and hurt their dogs in the name of training. It's absolutely disgusting. I know that it is a subject right now in the UK that is going to be debated because for various reasons, the shock collar industry do not like the fact that there is a potential ban in England. But that's it. So how can you, when you've got this vulnerable being, when you've got this animal, how can you be cruel? How can you not want to protect them? How can you not love them? How can
as
you
great
not
as
marvel
us.
At them?
As great as us in other ways, as if we're right. Great. You know, people always say, oh, they were behaving like animals. Animals don't behave as badly as us. We're the most destructive animal. And you're absolutely right. When I see a bear in a cage with extracting bear bile all its years, or an elephant made to dance, or, you know, an orangutan in a boxing match, or I see, you know, dressed up as a boxer, all the cruelty that we see. It's such abuse. It's such abasement. It's such a perversion. And it's a kind of self-hatred, because we're hating ourselves. We're lowering ourselves by doing it. And it's about the dignity of the animal, but it's about our dignity. What about the dignity of the people who do that to their fellow beings on this planet? And it's their planet too. Yeah, you're spot on. But I've got this from an early age when I was growing up. I'm adopted. And when I was adopted into our home, to my forever family, as they say, and I always say my real mum and dad, my adoptive mum and dad are my real mum and dad. And I went on the whole journey. And part of what I've written about is sort of reconciling why I didn't bond with my birth mother when I traced her, all that stuff. But so when I was adopted, we got a puppy as well, because my sister's 5 years older than me. And I think it was kind of, you know, all attention is going to be on baby Nicholas. And so we get a puppy from next door. And I remember the phrase was the academics next door. You know, one is terraced house in Edinburgh. It was the academics next door over the wooden fence. Their dog Judy had escaped one night. She was a fox terrier and she'd escaped and came back 2 days later. And they didn't realize she was pregnant until a few weeks later. Oh, so she had a liaison dangereux, whatever. And do you want that boy? He's moaning in the background. I think he probably wants. I'll let him out in a minute. And so there was a litter, and I got this. We got a puppy called Candy. And every day of my life, me and Candy were brothers, and we were completely bonded. And I wasn't aware that he was a canine or any different. As far as I was aware, he was just my brother. And we played together, and we crawled together, and we sniffed together. It was very embarrassing for my parents. Sometimes people would come to the door, and we'd both sniff them. And they'd say, don't, and obviously, it could be really embarrassing. We'd play fight all the time. Mm-hmm. Remember one woman, Mum used to tell the story of the woman who came to the door and said, your son's being mauled by a dog. And my mum say, no, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry about that. And so he was everything to me. The smell of his ears, the smell of his chair, being with him. And I just then, of course, 11 years old, get home from school. Where's Candy?
I can't even imagine.
You never forget.
No, you don't. You don't. I mean, that bond you're talking about, it can't be replicated. It's different with every animal. My grandmother grew up in a very well-to-do household, but her brothers were 10 years older than she was. She didn't have any friends, and except for the chauffeur, Cramwell, and her son Bernard, her dog. And so we always used to call my grandmother Granny Doggies, because She was surrounded by dogs all the time. And it was that relationship she had with that St. Bernard when she was little, that dog was her friend, that just cemented the lifetime of her love of dogs. It sounds very similar to what you experienced.
Yeah.
In your book, you mentioned about the breakdown that you had. It's quite a personal, you know, you're telling a lot about your personal life, but can you tell me a little bit about that, if you don't mind, and sort of elaborate a bit on it?
I don't mind, because he was instrumental. My boy Maxwell there. Because what happened was, things were getting on top of me. I wanted to save every single animal in the world. And I was spending hours and hours, because I've been diagnosed as bipolar, and I was spending hours and hours of sort of manically depressed time looking at, you know, saying, what can I do about this? Looking at the internet, looking at abuse, looking at things happening to animals all over the world. And I remember, like, Tina, my wife, comes, so what are you doing? Oh, I'm just doing my work, just doing my work. And then I carry on. I was doing it for hours, and I was away for quite a lot working, and I'd do it then. And everything just began to get on top of me because I couldn't do anything about it. And I felt useless. And then all of a sudden one day, the whole world pulled on me, and I thought, well, what's the point anymore? And I was going to Euston Station. I was meant to be getting on a train and going up to Manchester, where I also work, going up from London. And I remember I just collapsed, and it was my head in my hands. There was a bit of grass outside Euston Station. I just collapsed there, and my mobile phone for a while was fumbling. I just thought, you know, this is it. And I rang home, and Tina had seen it coming. She was obviously extremely concerned, and she said, come home. Come home to me, come home to the girls. And then she knew, and she said, and come home to Maxwell. Maxwell's waiting for you. And so, yeah, so I got on a taxi and I went home, and I came in, and she said, go to bed, go and lie down. You don't want to talk about it, because anyone with mental health issue will know, mental health problem will know that people say, what if you're depressed? What's wrong? And you don't want to say what's wrong, because the minute you say what's wrong, you start to feel that way again and even worse. So you don't want to articulate it. But the only person you really can articulate it to is an animal, sometimes a dog. And, you know, he's my therapist and he's my best friend. And because they don't ask questions, but they understand, they have empathy. They just naturally, and I lay on the bed just through there in despair. And I heard the little clink of his collar, and he came up, and he got onto the bed. And he put his paw on me. And you know, when he put his head on my chest.
Gosh. Oh, my gosh. He knew.
He put his head on my chest. And I felt this kind of charge of warmth and love. Of course he knew. Absolutely he knew. They have to know, though, don't they? You know this. They have to know. They have to through smell. I mean, can detect cancer. Of course they can detect hormones of how you feel. And in the wild, that's what the pack has to do for a fully, properly functioning, happy pack. They have to know how each of the individual is.
Well, it does. And it is also about survival.
Yeah.
You have to be able to read body language, and dogs have evolved to be able to read us to a certain extent. And they've had to because it's all about survival. they have to know when they need to get out of there.
Yeah.
But I think what you're talking about, that you... and everybody's experience is different, but seeing all of this cruelty, seeing what is happening in the world, seeing that, it's very, very hard to do. You get compassion fatigue. Certainly people that are in the rescue world get compassion fatigue. Veterinarians, the suicide rate amongst veterinarians is very high. And it's hard to do it, but you know that you're making a difference. And so for everything that you're doing now, including your wonderful podcast, it's making a difference, because now you're spreading joy to other people. And it's not just on a television show about people. Now you're spreading joy and giving people, educating people about animals and about how incredible they are. What was that journey like? How did you sort of come out of that to where you are now?
Well, I got help, and I got, the right medication. I got back on an even keel, and I did that thing that you have to do And anyone on the front line, whether they're working any kind of charity in a war zone or dealing with suffering, whether it be human suffering, whether it be animal suffering, you have to, in order to be effective, to be more effective, you have to find a distance so that you don't internalize it. Because the worst possible thing you can do is internalize it. Because if you internalize it and it just eats away at you and hurts you all the time, you can't do anything about it. And you're useless and you can't be of any use. And I've spoken to a lot of people on the front line doing this. And I said to Will Travers, you know, from Born Free, yeah, who's great.
Because you
said,
support the Born Free Foundation, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you hear him whining about?
Do you want out?
Hang on a second.
Well, let's have a look at, for those of you who are watching on YouTube, you can see Maxwell there. As you let him out, we can see him. There he is. Oh, he's gorgeous. Yeah. And he's 11, isn't he?
13.
Oh, he's 13. Gosh, he's 13 this week. Oh my goodness, you're 13 years old, boy. You are so. He looks great for 13. Goodness.
He's great for 13, isn't he?
Ooh.
A bit grey, but. Do you want out?
Yeah, he's like, I think so. Well, I don't know what I want. Shall I go or not? I think he's saying yeah.
I'll give you the option.
There you go. Oh, he says, I love you. He's looking at you. Oh, well, I thought we were going out. Oh, okay. Look at that.
What's he doing there? What's that mean?
I think he wants you to go out. I think he's pulling you to go out. I think if you went with him, seriously, he would take you out. He's like, come on,
yeah,
we're leaving
now. Yeah, he wants to go out. He actually literally does want to go for a walk because I take him for I think you suggest, it may have been you told me to do it. Taking for a walk whereby he just, you know, I let him sniff anything he wants to sniff.
Yes, it is. It's a sniffy walk. It's a sniffari. Hmm. And yeah, sniffaris are very, very good for these dogs.
And he comes back knackered, complete, because he's been processing such information. And he's got,
so much amazing information. If you think he's got up to a billion scent receptors in his nose.
Mm.
So that's so much information that he's gathering from his environment. And and that's why they do. So when people think, well, I'm going to take my dog out for exercise. Yes, some dogs need a lot of physical activity, but actually mental activity as well can be even more tiring. But I love their family. We have senior dogs. I have two senior dogs now. One is 12, one is 13 and a half. And, you know, they're our loves. I adopted one when she was 11, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. So I would say adopt the seniors. Don't forget them. Adopt senior dogs. But now you've started a podcast, and your podcast has helped me through the pandemic.
Wow.
I was on your podcast, which I was very, very thankful to be a guest. Thank you. But I do love it. What gave you the idea for doing your podcast?
Well, I just wanted to do it. And I just do it for fun. And I like radio. So I like making it. I make it myself. And I write music for it. And I record it. And I edit it. And it's great thinking of great people to have on it. And I like putting it together and thinking, what can I do? Having you on was great. Great reaction. We also had Ricky Gervais was on. Peter Egan, I know you had Peter on yours. I don't like go for the just for the celeb for the sake of the celeb. I want somebody who's genuinely passionate, who has something to offer.
Well, Ricky Gervais is very passionate. He does a lot of animal advocacy work.
Completely, and I like doing
and
features.
Peter Egan.
Yeah. I don't find a list of all the people on it because
Peter Egan's a very dear friend, and he is the most incredible man, and
he's amazing. I love him so much, and my God, he's so committed, isn't he?
Yep, he is
to this. But I just I love putting it together. I like doing features as well, because I've done like guide dogs and mm-hmm. also medical detection dogs. And I did one on, you know, police dogs. So I don't just do. So I'll do two things. I'll do an interview and also that. And because I think it's really interesting, like medical detect and also therapy dogs. I do therapy dogs as well. So I've got some of the guests here, yourself and Alexandra Horovitz, who
can
bring on dogs like you, comedian Kevin Bridges. You were on with Susie Dent, who's a massive star. And Gary Lineker, massive footballer. Andrew Cotter was on. Chris Packham, another legend. All sorts of people and features as well.
Yeah, Jeremy Paxman on, didn't you, just recently?
That was interesting. Jeremy Paxman, and then Claudio Soleri.
He was talking about
wild dogs.
Dogs.
Yeah, he's an expert on wild dogs. Solero. I'm so sorry, Claudio. I've had a long day. Claudio Solero, professor. He's like Mr. Wild Dog. And he knows everything about wild dogs. He studied Ethiopian, very threatened, the Ethiopian wolf. He's been there studying them. They got to trust him at close quarters for months, studying and all the canids. I think it's the 37 types of canid. And a lot of their behavior, so interesting, a lot of their behavior is, we can still see in your dogs and in Max. So you can still see that that behavior, the means of communication, the way they behave. What is interesting is that he told me that in the wild, and given the chance this would happen domestically, perhaps, the father takes an active role and genuinely is the family father and teaches the pup stuff, and they learn from it and plays with the pups and guards the pups. But of course, we don't give them the opportunity to do that here, because that's not how it swings, is it?
No. We've broken up the familial pack. It is very, you see, that's why we say in the training world that when we have a group of dogs together, we call them a group and not a pack, because pack is only really truly familial. When you say it's a dog pack, is it mum, dad and offspring? Because most of the dogs, if we have a multi-dog household, come from different families. So they actually can't be a true pack in the scientific definition. No. And so they're forming a group. So we call dogs like that a group, but they can still pick up those pack-like behaviors. And that's why, I mean, I've been studying dogs for 20 years now, and there's always something new to learn. And so when you have people like Alexandra Horowitz, who you had on, she actually came. We just had a My Dog Behavior Conference that we have every year, and it's been virtual for the last 2 years. But we had Alexandra Horowitz on, and she's talking about scenting and how dogs smell things. Did you know? And this is what I didn't know. I mean, I feel like I know a lot about how.
Before you tell me that pack thing is interesting, because I did read this recently.
Yeah.
That they study wolves in captivity, and they think they're studying wolf packs, but they're not studying wolf packs.
No, they're not. And so
they infer all this information about, oh, in captivity, and that's where all this stuff about, very often, the alpha comes from, or the pack leader comes from. And it's actually, if you see wolves in the wild, if you're lucky enough to do that, it's a different deal, isn't it?
Totally different deal, because you're talking about more of a familial pack in the wild. Yeah. But we can't take, and they did scientific experiments or research in the 1970s, where they did bring wolves from different families into a confined area. And so these captive wolves, they watched them, they watched how they interacted, and they sort of lifted a lot of the behavior that they saw and sort of put that on dogs as well. Well, if wolves do this, dogs must do this as well. So that's where all the alpha came. You have to be pack leader. And we know that actually with our multi-dog household, the dogs don't behave that way, that there's no coming into the family and saying, okay, I'm going to be the head of the family, I'm going to try and take over as top dog. There can be issues over resources, and that's where you might get some controlling behavior. But I think it's really interesting that you bring that up with the whole alpha theory and the pack theory, about how it's been taken by some trainers and made law, when actually it does pertain to wolves, it does pertain to wild dogs in some ways, but not
more subtly than they think.
More subtly, and not to our multi-dog household.
Yeah. Can I just ask you something about the resources thing before you tell me this amazing fact? I'm teeing up this amazing fact
I'm excited to tell you, because I'm very squirrel-like, so I'm glad you sort of put me back.
Okay, no, that's fine. I want the fact. We'll need a when we get the fact. I've got three dogs, as you know, I've discussed them. And this is a little bit of professional advice or observation from yourself, which would be great. Because basically, I've got two West Highland Terriers, 10-year-old mother, Misty, who's an extraordinary character. They are such characters with their different little peculiarities and foibles. I just love them. And she's got a daughter, Maisie, who's six, who's always lived here. No separation, no attachment issues. She sleeps where she was born, and she's the happiest little dog. And we call her the human dog. She's so attached to Tina, because she was the first out, and Tina had to feed her by pipette. And so for a while before Misty had finished or started feeding them. And so they're delightful, intelligent dogs. And then there's Maxwell. And Maisie absolutely adores Maxwell. But, and she'll never take food from her mother. Even when her mother, the three of them out there, and her mother moves back and has a breather and has maybe eaten a carrot before she goes back into the bowl or something, or a little bit of carrot, Maisie will not dare take her mother's food. But Maxwell will have a bone or something, and she'll just go up and she'll take it off him. And he'll just walk away, you know. And she'll literally, and if he's having a bone, because he had a bone the other day because it was his birthday, and he was in the garden down there, and he was having a bone, and she's banging on the door to get out. Yeah. So I think one of the girls led her out. She's straight to him, grabs his bone, and goes, and he just is resigned to it, you know. He's okay, she's taking my bone, whatever. Goes, what's going on there?
Well, it all depends on access to resources and who wants to have primary access to what and who puts value on that primary access. So, for example, in a multi-dog household, you might have one dog that puts more value on a sleeping area, but the other dog puts more value on food. So it works because, for example, if Maxwell's chewing on a bone and Maisie comes up and takes the bone away, he's like, oh, okay, whatever. He doesn't mind. But if Maxwell was really... he wanted primary access to a sleeping area that has to be his sleeping area and didn't want Maisie or anyone, he would certainly tell them, no, this is mine. And he might not growl. It might just be a look. And that's why multi-dog households work when dogs place different values on different things and priority access to different things, and the others defer to them.
Yeah, so they've got their own sort of structure. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like it when they play fight, when the mother and the daughter, Misty and Maisie, when they play fight and they're rolling over each other. He doesn't like it when they're doing that.
Yes, he probably makes him a little anxious.
He goes,
Yeah, he doesn't. And that's pretty normal, actually, certainly in households with three, where two dogs are playing with each other and the other dog gets frightened a little bit anxious, walks away, or gets in there and tries to break it up. I've seen that as well.
Wow.
So, and that's why studying multi-dog households really fascinates me, because that whole idea that your dogs are violent and they fight a lot and there's going to be a lot of fighting. Actually, dogs don't want to be violent. They don't want to fight. It's not good for survival. Fighting is not good, because if you're wounded, that's going to compromise your own survival. So dogs will naturally defer. So this whole idea that your dog comes into your household and tries to take over as lead of the pack, that's not what they're doing. The whole idea of dominance, it's a social relationship between animals of the same species, but dominance works because of deference. So Maisie is deferring to her mother when her mother's eating. That keeps the peace. Maisie's not stupid enough to try and take food, even if her mother backs away from it.
She's not going to do it.
She's not going to do it. She's smart. And that's all to do with survival. And plus, you know, you've got that. You do have a little pack there. You do have mama and daughter.
But her head's in his bowl. Not her mother's
bowl. That's fine. Isn't it amazing when you
interesting?
When you
so interesting.
Dog, every dog's unique. Every dog is different. That's why I love my job, and that's why, you know, we keep learning. But I'm going to get back. Can you do the drum
roll? Give me the fact.
This is a really cool fact.
Maybe a piano roll. Hang on.
Do you have? Oh, are you going to? It's going to play the piano. Go on. Because you do some really good stuff in your podcasts.
It's not working. Here we go. All right.
I've never had this before.
Fact!
Thank you very much. Did you know...
that wasn't very good, but anyway, fact.
I was impressed. Did you know that your dog sniffs 7 times a second? So that means a sniff in and a sniff out. They can do that 7 times in 1 second. You try it.
Yeah, it's moving really quick, isn't it? And it's the nares
at the side. So there's little, so the nares would be the nostrils, the little slits at the side. So what dogs are doing is that they are taking in information up the nose. For those of you who are listening to the podcast, you can't see what I'm doing, but I'm putting my fingers up my nose. And so as air goes in, it's almost like a little circle that's happening. Air comes out at the side. So it doesn't disturb their breathing, because when we breathe in, we then breathe out.
So it's basically
in scent and they breathe out. So it's basically like, yes.
That's the sound of a backstage at Rolling Stones concert in 1971, right?
That's the reason why you like that, liked it there. but humans can only do it about 1.5 times per second.
Wow.
We can only sniff 1.5 times a second. Dogs can do it 7 times per second. I think that's pretty amazing. Great fact. from Alexandra Horowitz. Not friendly.
Unbelievable. And that's why the sniff walk is so good. What are they smelling? It's amazing. Well, what world are they in?
Okay, well, you can experience this. Look, we have forgotten how to smell things. We look at things. Our sight is our dominant sense. We've forgotten how to smell things. And I'm not just saying, well, I can smell the bread when it's cooking or the donuts when they're being made. No, I'm talking about going outside after this podcast. Go outside, put your nose up to the bark of the tree trunk or to a leaf or down on the grass and smell. Take that scent in. You see, we don't use our sense of smell enough now. But when you do that, you awaken this almost this primeval ability to be able to smell. And it is incredible. You get an idea of, yes, that grass does have a scent. That bit of grass smells different from that piece of grass. And, well, when a dog's urinated on it and a couple of dogs have urinated on it, that smells very different too. You get this idea, just a small idea, of what our dogs' scenting abilities are like and how incredible they are and how their world is smell. How do dogs tell time? Because the smell in your house is very different and the airflow is very different in your house in the morning than it is in the evening. They can smell that. So, to me, it's
incredible. On smell. David Bowie, do you want to know what he smelled like?
Please, could you please? But don't tell me anything that I don't want to know.
No, it's good. It's all
the
good.
The photograph I had of him on my wall has stayed with me forever.
And I'll never forget the smell when I'm speaking to him. Never forget it. French cigarettes and expensive cologne.
Did he really? I could imagine that.
Really beautiful, expensive cologne.
Oh, God,
and just a hint of the Gaulois, you know, the French cigarette. Not cigarette, French cigarettes.
Yeah. Wow.
Good smell, cigarettes.
I'm so happy you said that.
And like French cigarettes, that's the smell of a little cobbled street in Normandy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or in France, when you're walking down, you smell the coffee and you can smell that lovely aroma of French cigarettes and coffee. And it was like that, but expensive cologne as well.
Ever smelled that cologne again, that would evoke that memory.
I got some Old Spice. Old Spice was the aftershave we used to have when we were kids.
Yeah,
and I found out that they still did it. And so I got it. It wasn't quite the same, but it was 95% the same. Mm. And I smelt it and I was all of a sudden was back there, 15 years old, going out, meeting my girlfriend, meeting the gang, and I was there. It's like music. Now it's powerful. Smells. I once was walking along Oxford Street and I got a whiff of somebody had, I think it's a Body Shop body lotion on, and it reminded me of former girlfriend. And I was like, right back. I look around, right back there. So that's a little tiny little hint of a beginning of an embryo of the start of the foot of the mountain and dogs are at the summit.
You know what? When you smell something like that, I have the same thing when it's been hot and the rain falls and the smell from the hot tarmac reminds me of Wimbledon tennis because my house backed up to the practice courts of the Wimbledon tennis complex in Wimbledon. And that smell, I worked for many years during the Wimbledon 2 weeks as a chauffeur, as a waitress, as a security guard for them. And that smell takes me right back there. And why does
it's got a name. It's got a name.
What's that?
Did you know that's a word for it? The rain on the concrete, the smell of it. Yeah.
No. I don't know what that word is.
This is my fact. You gave me a brilliant fact.
Go on, then.
Petrichor.
Petrichor.
Petrichor. Let me look it up for you so I can give
Never
you the exact
spelling.
Yeah, because we've got a weatherman on the radio, Simon King, and it's one of his favourite words. It's that smell, a very unique smell.
It is very unique.
It's a beautiful smell. And we can all... Petrichor, there it is. A pleasant smell that frequently accompanies the first rain after a long period of warm, dry weather. Petrichor.
There you go.
And that's the smell on the concrete that you're...
Thank you.
P-E-T-R-I-C-H-O-R, petrichor.
Okay.
And it's caused by, because everything has a chemical root. What does that mean? I don't know. Anyway, the smell is believed to be caused by a liquid mixture of organic compounds which collects in the ground and ichor or whatever, and then the rain falls on it and it's all released and it's a beautiful smell, and it reminds me of Edinburgh as well. Does walking it? Along the old stone pavements of Edinburgh, and then the rain and that smell after the rain, and there's wonderful lush hedges and the whole thing, and I'm there. Isn't that interesting? The what other smells take you back? That's a great smell.
There's a bad smell that takes me back, and it's the dentist chair, Dr. Kettle. I don't think he's still alive. When I had to go to the dentist, and he operated in Wimbledon as well, and that was the smell of the liquid that they used, the mouthwash. I don't know what it was, but I could never understand why Dr. Kettle, and I used to be terrified sitting back in his chair, and they had some sort of trying to make the kids feel happier by this poster that was stuck up on the wall. So as you were about to pee your pants, you could see this nice cartoon up on the wall. But Dr. Kettle had the most terrible teeth. They looked like tombstones in his mouth.
He was a dentist?
And he was a dentist. And I could never work out why, but he would always put this thing in my mouth and he would go, wet and windy, you know, that stuff that sucks up all your saliva, wet and windy. And then he would, the smell of that, that takes me right back there every time into Dr. Kettle's chair. What about you? Any more? Yeah. Any other smells?
Oh, I'm sure they'll come to me. But, you know, vinyl.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. I've got a record player over there, an old record player, which actually I left it on all night. Now I must get it fixed. So some of these experts, let me get a bit of vinyl here. I've got some old vinyl.
What? Yeah. Oh, there's nothing better than the old vinyl. No. People have gone to make a cup of tea now because they're like, oh, okay, you just carry on and reminisce.
Right. I've got it here, the proper vinyl.
Oh, that's a 45, isn't it?
Yeah. Ooh, and if you heat it up, if you put it on the record player and it would heat up, then you'd smell it. That's a smell, isn't it?
That is vinyl. A smell. That's really evocative smell. And the reason why this happens so fast is because, of course, all our sensory processes happen very quickly. But when we see things, when we hear things, that they have to go through all areas of the brain to get to the amygdala, the emotional center. But smell goes straight there. It doesn't bypass other areas of the brain. It goes straight there to our amygdala, our emotional center of the brain. And that's why smell is so important in evoking certain memories.
Absolutely. But so we're getting a little bit, as I tried to say earlier on, of the dog's world.
We really are. And I think, you know, you're talking about empathy. To begin with, we're talking about empathy and that our dogs empathize with us. And I truly believe that when we learn more about dogs, when we learn about all animals, but especially because we're focusing on dogs here, when we learn more about dogs and what makes them tick and how incredible they are, we become more empathetic towards them. And I believe when we become more empathetic towards them, we're going to treat them better. Now, you and I don't need a lesson on how to treat them better. There's many people out there that do. And that's why, you know, I might be called a snowflake. I might be called all kinds of names under the sun. But I've held the banner of positive training, and that means humane training. I do say no to my dogs. But it means humane training, and I've held that for 20 years, and I'm proud of it, and I'm going to carry on. And that leads me to say that I will be coming back to do a project in the UK soon, so I'll be able to keep that banner flying.
Can you come meet Misty and Maxwell and Maisie?
I would love to.
Yeah.
I would really love to. And I would. I'm
excited. I do one thing.
I'll be back in England for one and a half years.
Since the RSPCA Awards, maybe. But there's one thing I do, which I'm not sure that I should, because I discovered when she was very young, I was going like this one day, I was just sitting there going, and I looked at her and her ears were back.
I don't like it.
She didn't like it at all. The others, whatever. She didn't like it. And all I was doing was, and Tina doesn't like, and occasionally, like when she's chasing a squirrel, I'll go in and I'll go, and then she'll come out from chasing the squirrel. And I do this thing that I think it's really selfish and bad, and you'll take me off, but I'm lying there, and I wanted to come and sit on my lap, and I'll just go, that tiny bit of it, just a, and she hears it, and she hears it go back, and she'll come over, and she'll lie on me, and then expose her belly to be tickled. Now, this is what it's probably bad that I'm doing that.
I don't think she understands the noise, and I think she can't, she finds it difficult to process what it means. And so the ears back is a little bit of deference, a bit of appeasement. Hmm. She doesn't understand it. So now she's going to give you signals like going on her back, like putting the ears down, slightly submissive. I don't know what you're going on about, but I'm just going to defer a little and show you some appeasement just in case. That's what she's doing.
She'll come over from basically the other side of the room.
So she's not scared by it.
No.
She's curious, but that doesn't mean to say that dogs can't be conflicted.
Yes.
And there's a lot of conflict in dog behavior. So they're trying to work it out. And while they're trying to work it out, they give you these appeasement gestures just in case. So a lot of people, even when she goes back on her back, yes, she might like a belly rub, but going on her back is submission. Yes. It is an appeasement gesture. And for many, especially if you greet a dog for the first time, the dog doesn't know you and it goes on its back. Unless it's a really wiggly, happy to see you dog, don't pet its tummy, because that's a cutoff signal. That's basically a signal saying, okay, please don't touch me. That's how a lot of people get bitten. Not from your own dog, because you know your dogs, you understand your dog's signals. But I think it's really interesting. See, that's what I love. And that's why I've geeked out on this stuff for so many years. I started off as an actor, but my second string to my bow was always dogs. And then it became my first
milieu. Life. That's why you're so brilliant. You just have this natural understanding. You just kind of, I think you must have a wavelength that gets right through to dogs.
I'm channeling my grandma. A vibe. I think so.
It's a vibe.
I'm a good observer. Nikki, you are, I have to say, I know in your podcast, one of the family, when you were talking to Jeremy Paxman, you were saying like, oh, I was so nervous about doing this. And then I think he said,
Don't be such a silly old woman.
Silly old woman. And that just had me laughing. And then you did this little tune after that. So I was dancing around to that. I love your podcast. People have to listen to your podcast. Where can they find them? I get them on Google Podcasts.
Yeah, they're all there. They're on all of them. One of the family. Yeah, it's okay. On Apple and Acat, whatever it's called, and Spotify. It's all there. Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I encourage people to watch it. Can you tell us what do you have any exciting things coming up?
Well, I've got a couple of different ones. Heidi Allen, who's a former MP, is now head of the RSPCA, and I'm getting four people. Two young environmental campaigners, and Dom Dyer, who's great, and Peter Egan. And I'm going to get them all to ask her questions about what our priorities should be, where we should be heading, what kind of world do we want for animals, what we can achieve realistically in the years to come to make this country, the United Kingdom, a better place for animals. And that's coming up. And there's another one which is a bit different. It's not about dogs, but I see us as animals. So I've got a special. We're all animals. And it's not one of the family. It's one of the human family. And it's so interesting. And I hope people go with it, because it's not dogs. Because, you can be all embracing on podcasts. You can have a sort of central theme, but you can talk around and all that stuff, which is what you do brilliantly. We've done a bit. And I was reading two books I got, because I'm interested in human evolution. And I was reading two books by two different people, both fantastic, about Neanderthals. Neanderthals. And we're discovering more every week about these people. And I thought, wow. People say, oh, he's a complete Neanderthal.
It's a derogatory word.
We're discovering they had culture, and these people, they loved and they laughed and they had joy and they had pain and they had hopes and they talked about their dreams with each other. We're not directly related. We're cousins. We have a common ancestor. And so I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to get the two people on? And it's not come out yet, this. And to get the two people on and to say everything you never knew and wish you did about Neanderthals. So I'm just asking basic questions like, did they sing? You know, did they eat each other? Did they wear clothes? And they're brilliant experts. So it's kind of one of the human family. Do you think it's a bit of a risk?
I think it's brilliant. No, I think it's brilliant. I think people will be fascinated by it.
Because we don't know much at all.
What we learn at school, but we don't know much at all. Wouldn't it be? I think that's fascinating. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
Very excited. Nikki, thank you for all the work that you do for animals and beyond. Thank you for entertaining us for so many years, so many years to come. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast.
Well, I just want to say one more thing.
Thank you, everybody. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for tuning in to Victoria Stilwell's Positively Podcast. For more information, visit positively.com. Get connected on Facebook and YouTube as Victoria Stilwell, or follow her on Twitter at Victoria S. Be sure to tune in next time as Victoria helps to change dogs' lives positively.